Good stuff to come. But first, let's get to our quick interview. I'd like to introduce Doug Scott, legendary alpinist, who's been climbing an awfully long time. Welcome in studio, Doug. I appreciate it. Thanks for taking time tonight.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Brendan.
And I hear you'll be giving a presentation tonight via the Ogden Valley Winter Sports Foundation down at the Da Vinci Academy. That is this evening at 7 o'clock. For those who want to purchase tickets for that, they're still available. I guess you do get them down at the Da Vinci Academy.
Right. You can pick them up at the door.
And they are $20?
$12 for the presentation.
$12 for the presentation. There's a pre-party at the front climbing gym. For those who want to attend that, it's an additional fee. So to Duke, if you don't mind, can I give a brief history of what I see on your website here? Doug can claim the first ascent of the west face of Everest. This was just a couple years ago in 1975.
Southwest
face. Mm-hmm. Summited 40 different peaks, half of which were either new ascents or new routes on. Summited all seven summits. And you began climbing at the age of 12 with first lead documents in 1953. And, boy, you've climbed an awfully long time, including the first ascent of, is it Targo Ri in Tibet in 2000?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also the president of the Alpine Club from 1999 to 2001. So you'll be giving a presentation tonight, and the title of the presentation is?
It's Significant and Joyous Moments in the Mountains.
Yeah, very, very good. And I tell you what, for those of us who love the mountains, a lot of times they do bring us joy and a significant amount of joy. And you've spent plenty of time in the mountains. Is there an incident or any type of a main thought that you have, a theme that will be presented in tonight's discussions?
I will mention the southwest face of Everest.
Yes.
Because that was quite significant as a climb, kind of historically, in that it showed once and for all that if you do take enough men and materials to the mountain and you fix ropes and you have all the Sherpa support and use oxygen and you're well led and you've got reasonable weather, you can more or less guarantee you're doing anything.
Right.
So since the uncertainty as to outcome is one of the main ingredients of climbing, what's the point of doing that again? So after that, all of us on that trip then went off and did other climbs in a more adventurous style, without the fixed ropes, without the oxygen, without all the Sherpas. And so it was a bit of a milestone in the Himalayan climbing at that time. And for me personally, Dougal Haston, my partner and I didn't get to the summit until 6 in the evening for a glorious sunset. And it was mind-boggling place to be at that time of night. When the sun had finally gone, we thought we'd better go, and we didn't get down too far before the head torches failed, and we had to sleep just 300 feet down from the summit.
Oh, wow.
Without sleeping bags, and about minus 45 centigrade. That's about the same Fahrenheit, I think. And then without oxygen, because that had gone long ago. So that fact did really widen what and how I might climb in the future, because the assumption being if you could risk an unplanned bivouac up there without sleeping bags and oxygen and without getting frostbite, you could probably risk it anywhere.
Right.
With the snow to dig a cave to get out of the wind. And so from then on, I did actually more climbing after that, I was 34 then, in the Himalaya than I'd done before.
So. Interesting. Hmm. So basically pioneered this idea of going fast and light.
Well, it's something that everyone did at one time before the big national expeditions to Everest, K2, Nanga Parbat, Kanchenjunga. I mean, there have been some huge expeditions to Everest, of course. The Italians, Duke, Monzino, he took 65 Italians, 100 Sherpas, 2,000 porters to Everest in 73. It's a bit of overkill.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how it is these days, you know, with 1,000 people or more at base camp.
Right.
I mean, at least until 1986, you did have Everest to yourself. After that date, the Nepalese allowed anyone to go there that could pay. So that's when you start to get the crowds going, and Well, it's not the place for solitude. I mean, all those people that get up, wonderful experience for them, but I wouldn't like to be with them, actually, because there's just too many.
Right.
Too busy.
Right. Well, and there's been many changes in climbing over the years since the 1950s. What was maybe one of the more impactful changes you've seen of recent?
Well, time? Just the sheer numbers that have got involved. One time on the crags in Britain, you'd more or less know everybody or knew somebody that knew him. And but now it's just people are swarming all over the rocks and mountains since the advent of the indoor climbing walls mainly. And that's one of the problems, that the indoor climbing wall is inherently safe, as it has to be, because the people that own it are going to be liable for all kinds of being sued out of the, you know, out of existence if they get it wrong. So it's you know, it's ultimately safe there. But of course, people going outdoors looking around for the same safety features.
Right.
Where are the bolts? As you said at the beginning, bolts to clip. I mean, this is the problem, that all those young kids starting indoors want the same outdoors.
Right.
And that isn't sort of where it's at.
Right. You
know? I mean, it's great where there's bald limestone faces, slate quarries, schist rock, where you can't protect your own life. But on granite, invariably, there are good crack systems where you can insert your own protection. And every piece of protection you put in is going to be different from the last. And so you're really going to have to use your imagination and be imaginative with your limited resources to protect your own life. And it becomes a bit of an art form in itself, and a real adventure, a memorable. I mean, the sport climb isn't that adventurous because you just clip your bolt, and it's the same kind of thing you do here as you do in sort of New York State or, you know, over in Russia or Britain or anywhere on the south coast where there's sport climbing. So, you know, it's a bit like McDonald's. You go out, if you were with your partner in the evening, think, well, where should we go for a meal tonight? And if the only choice was McDonald's, well, I mean, it suits a lot of people, doesn't it?
McDonald's, sure does,
it's
yep.
safe and, you know, it's predictable.
You know what you're going to get, yep.
You know what you're going to get, and no risk. But some of us like to now and again go off to a restaurant we don't know about, and it's perhaps got a bit more adventurous cuisine on the go. Same with our climbing. It'd be good if they can just keep a little bit of rock in its natural state, so we can go over there and climb up to the rock, not go to rock that's been brought down for us by some perhaps well-intentioned do-gooder that wanted to make it safe. Mm. Yeah, it's a big issue. And I didn't like the sound of that starting piece when you were clipping these bolts.
Clipping your first bolt, right.
Because really, we want to hear the rustle of gear being chosen and put into the cracks. And you know.
Yeah, good perspective, good perspective. So again, we're speaking with legendary alpinist Doug Scott. You have a presentation tonight down at the Da Vinci Academy at 7 o'clock. Tickets are still available. And they support, or all the proceeds go to exactly?
Well, actually, since I've become old and feeble, I've still got a good excuse to keep going to the Himalaya, because we have started Community Action Nepal. I've got about 50-odd projects on the go.
Okay.
About eight quite big schools and nine rural health posts, and we're building porter rescue shelters and that sort of thing. So we're trying to raise about £250,000, about $400,000 a year to keep it all going. So anything coming from this talk tonight would be really useful. Now, I will have some posters and things to sell on behalf of CAN, Community Action Nepal.
Okay, excellent. And then do you follow some of the newer climbers like Uli Steck and maybe some of the mountain runners like Killian Jornet, who they seem to just run up mountains like Mont Blanc these days? I don't know if you follow.
I know Uli Steck. I know Uli. I was at his talk in London recently when I think it's all this dry tooling that really has got them going, because they're more or less hooked the way up, like the Eiger North Face and so on.
Is that something that appeals to you?
Well, I was quite pleased once years ago when we did Troll Wall, the previous ascent of that taking 3 days, and we managed to do it in 17 hours. So I was quite chuffed.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I can't say we're out to do anything like beat the clock as they do these days. It was more, we had become quite efficient, our little crowd from Nottingham, where I was born and raised. We've been climbing all around the Dolomites and Yosemite and Baffin Island. And when we got to do Troll Wall, we were just used to each other's systems and the systems of big wall climbing, and naturally did it fast. And it's very satisfying to do it fast and safe if there's bad weather threatening in the big mountains. But I don't know about putting all that effort into being virtually an Olympic athlete. I mean, Ulis Tek is an Olympic athlete, the way he trains. It's just a phenomena, really.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we watched the videos on him and things, so that's about all I know. I haven't seen him climb in person or anything. Mm-hmm. So very good. And then finally, before we let you take off for this afternoon, do you have any advice for those of us that want to get out into the mountains and explore and stay safe and maybe are kind of new to the sport of alpine?
Well, the best thing is to, if you want, it depends on how far you want to take it, but if you want to take it all the way to the Himalaya, I really do recommend starting on small mountains like around here. Mm-hmm. Well, not so small, but and then certainly bigger than Britain. Serve your apprenticeship, basically. Go from step by step. You know, if you're starting young, you've got a whole lifetime. Because, I mean, it's not like athletics where you pass your best and you more or less pack up. But with climbing, you just go on and on. I was climbing in North Conway 3 days ago at my advanced years with a bit of help from my friends. But no, still enjoying it. I mean, you can carry on enjoying it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But it's worth making sure you survive that long by serving a long apprenticeship, step by step, going off eventually from here to perhaps Denali and then, you know, 6,000-7,000 meter mountains in the Himalaya before ever going on to something like Everest. I mean, you could just go to Everest, pay you $65,000, sign on, become like a dog on a lead, and be dragged up, or, you know, taken between two super guides. The Sherpas have hammered out the path, they're put in the camps, they cook the meals, you're told where to camp, when to move, when to go down. I mean, that's not the way you want to do it.
Right.
You want to be making your own decisions. You know, our climb is all about making judgments all the time as to what the weather's doing and the conditions and how you're feeling, how your friends are feeling, and working together, you know. But it's all about a team effort where you look out for each other all the way and don't get into this kind of guide dependency syndrome where you give up, absolve yourself from all further responsibility for anyone else and even yourself. You've read Cracker's book on the 96 tragedies. He himself got that on the mountain. He himself gave up looking after his friend. So he'd paid the guy to do that, you know. So it hits even good alpinists like him. And so best is to, you know, become a climber in your own right, not just sign up for to let someone else have your kicks for you, you know.
Right.
As Bob Dylan said.
Good reference. Well, very excellent. And this evening is the full presentation. We look forward to, again, it's at the Da Vinci Academy tonight at 7 o'clock. And so, Doug Scott, I appreciate you coming in studio, and we'll see you tonight.
Thanks, Brendan.
Thank you.
Thank you.